You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. With more than 30 weekly podcasts, HRN has something for every food lover. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by 818 Tequila. Handcrafted, expert approved, with over 20 international blind tasting awards. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York, 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Welcome to Pizza Quest. I'm Peter Reinhardt, a man on a never-ending search for the perfect pizza. This show is the audio version of the Pizza Talk YouTube series, where I engage in interesting conversations with some of the country's greatest pizza makers and other artisans. Thanks for joining me on this quest.
Welcome to Pizza Quest with Peter Reinhardt. And I'm Peter Reinhardt, here with my longtime friend, Michael Colanti, who's joining us today from San Francisco. Michael and I go back a long way, both to our days working together at the California Culinary Academy, but we even predate that. Before we knew each other, we have something else in common, which is a very strong bond for anybody from Philadelphia. We're both from the Philadelphia area, and so we've got a lot of common bonds. So we're going to talk about all of that today, and especially what I'm excited about. And by the way, welcome, Michael. Thank you for joining us. I want to hear about this new project that you're working on, developing a new kind of a bread, a pizza-style bread for one of our favorite places, Delfina and Pizzeria Delfina in San Francisco. And I had a chance to visit with you recently, you know, at Delfina and taste your new bread. And we said, we've got to get an episode of Pizza Quest to talk about this. But we're going to come back to that after we kind of bring everybody else up to date. Some of our viewers will know you from the Bread Symposium, where you made a great presentation a few months ago, your topic was it?
Prebiotics, that's right. Fibers for digestive health and how to get that into your pizzas and into your breads.
Right. And back when we first met in person, you were at the California Culinary Academy. You were department chair there. You actually were the one who hired me. I think you're the one who signed me up to teach there, where we worked together for about 5 years. And you were a pastry chef then. So there has to have been a life before that that led up to you becoming a pastry chef. So I want to hear a little bit about your own journey. You know, both, I think you were trained in France, if I'm not mistaken, and how you kind of became a pastry chef and you were teaching pastry. And then when I left California Culinary Academy to go to Johnson & Wales, you took over the bread class that I was teaching and suddenly went from pastry to bread. We kind of pulled you over from the pastry side
to the dark side.
Yeah, we got you over to fermentation, to the fermentation side. So we want to hear all about that whole journey. But why don't you take us back a little bit and just, how it all started and happened for you?
Well, thanks, Peter. And, back to, you just as an aside said, I'm the one that hired you. I have to say that is one of the smartest things I've ever done.
Thank you.
Because when you did leave, you had instilled in me enough of love for fermentation and yeast that it began my own bread and pizza quest. And I've been on that now for 2.5 decades. So,
and who knew? Who knew back then for either of us that fermentation and bread were going to become such a big thing? When you brought me on at the school, the bread program at the California Culinary Academy consisted of a couple of things out of the Gieselin book on how to make a basic fast fermentation baguette and a few soft rolls and things like that. It was all basic stuff. And then we, pioneered there, bringing in the long, artisan techniques, the long fermentation and all that. That was just getting started then. But none of us, I think, had a clue that it was going to explode and be such a paradigm changer for the whole, baking community.
You're exactly right. And that, I always tell my students to this very day, if you love it, you just have to do it, because it will take you places. Once you put your soul and your heart into it, then it just takes care of you.
Yeah. So, yeah, I agree. Yeah. And it did. Before I met you, you were already a pastry chef. I already knew you actually from videos that I had seen on TV of you cooking at the Academy. There were these cooking programs that you did for them, and you were making things. You had a technique when you were teaching your students how to roll out laminated doughs that I still use to this day. I still quote you 30 years later almost. Because I remember it was one of those instructions that kind of stuck with me, which was when you roll out your dough, always move from the center to the corners, roll from the center to the corners, center to the corners. And that became almost a mantra for me when I was teaching my students on how to roll out their croissant doughs and Danish doughs and things like that.
Wow, you're taking me back, because that actually I learned from my French mentor.
Wow.
Who had a pastry shop. He used to run, his name was Pierre, and he used to run the Le Notre production shop.
Wow.
In Provence. So he made pastries and breads and everything, and he got out of that business and wanted to establish his own pastry shop just north of Paris a little bit. Uh-huh. And when he moved into town, he put terror into all the other bakers and everything. And so he had to make a deal with them that he would not make bread. He would only make pastries.
Wow.
And I was the beneficiary of that, because during the day, of course, I was his pastry apprentice. But then after everything was said and done, he would say, all right, now let me teach you how to bake. So I started to get, I was very clumsy with it, but I started to understand fermentation.
Wow. See, I had no idea. What is it about French chefs and pastry chefs that they rule by terror? They are the most frightening people in the world. Is it something that there's a program for how to become intimidator?
You know what? That was a poor choice of words on my part.
But that's really been my experience as well. I mean, this sense of intimidation is like...
Well, it wasn't that when I was talking about Pierre. It was that he was so well known. I mean, talk about somebody whose reputation precedes them. Here he was in the south of France, and his reputation went all the way up to Normandy. And when he moved into this little town, I mean, you know, it's like, you're like, okay, what's going to happen here? So that was really the sense of terror I was talking about.
I think it comes with the package.
Well, I must say, I when I met him, I actually was doing a stage in the kitchen in Paris. I thought I wanted to be a chef, and it was grueling. It was hot. It was like, you know, Anthony Bourdain, Kitchen Confidential kind of. It was like all of that stuff. I was just not ready for that. So there was a pastry chef. He used to come in. This was Pierre. He would come in once or twice a week because the restaurant didn't have enough space for its own pastries. And he would assemble out in the alley behind the restaurant. He would bring his flatbed truck down and with his work tables on it and refrigerated things. He would wipe it all down and he would put together mousse cakes and very simple things. I used to hang out in the alley with him, and he was 6'8" if he was an inch.
Wow.
And but his touch, I mean, he could touch pastry dough and it would just do what he said.
Wow.
And that's where I said, you know, it's like, teach me how to do this.
Yeah. He was like the pastry whisperer.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Wow. Well before that phrase even existed.
Yes.
But so I went and worked with him and learned the basics of pastry, not so much bread at this point, and came back to Philadelphia and was hired by a school there, I'm sure you remember, called the Restaurant School.
Restaurant School in Philadelphia, yeah.
And they had a culinary program, but they did not have a baking and pastry program. So they enlisted me and they said, hey, why don't you build this for us? In undergrad, I had a lot of experience in education, and I had some connections at DuPont Circle in Washington with the the government and how they lend money to students and all that kind of stuff. Wow. So I had that connection. And so I said, sure, I'll build you a baking and pastry program. So I learned how to do that. I went back to France a couple times to actually teach me these techniques, teach me that.
Yeah, that's great. It's great that you could do that and that you had the connections over there to do that.
It was great. But you know what? And this is how pastry chefs and bakers are. And you know that, we're very forthcoming with things. And I was able to go to some of the biggest names in Philadelphia, like Gunther Hyland at the
legendary
Hotel Gunther Hyland and everything. And these are our master chefs, and say, teach me how to make, a dobash tort. And so I really got a lot of field training in that regard. So
you're so fortunate. And like you say, so many of the baking and pastry masters were very generous with their knowledge. You and I also got to work with a guy who wasn't quite as generous in San Francisco. If you recall, a guy named Bo, who used to teach. Do you remember this? He used to teach his students at the academy up to a certain point. And then he would do like the most important step, and he would turn his back, and the students couldn't see around him to see what was the final step that he did. That he would always keep one little secret from them. Do you remember that?
I have to say, I don't know that particular characteristic.
Well, he was a legendary instructor, because he wrote this beautiful cookbook, The Art of Pastry, Bo Freeberg. And Bo was, was legendary. But that was the one thing that everybody who I knew who worked with Bo all said, did he do this to you too? He turned his back at the last minute and not show you that last little technique.
It was part of his MO. I have to say, I never experienced that. But my feeling really for the people that I've got to work with in this industry, in so many different countries, in France, in Italy, in Brazil, and just wherever I went, bakers and pastry chefs always just seemed like, oh, come on in, because we'll show you how to do this. And I think the thing, especially with bakers, with dough, with pizza, is that, it's so subjective to the environment that it's in. Mm-hmm. If you come and take a class with me in San Francisco, where our water is this pH and our ambient temperature is always this, et cetera, I can show you things, but you have to go home. You have to take that to your environment, and pretty darn quickly, you have to start trying to replicate it, or it's just going to fade from your memory. So I've encouraged that in my students. I encourage that with my clients. They're always saying to me, well, you're so giving with your information. And I'm like, well, you have to learn how to do it.
Yeah.
So I'm happy to show you, because as you know, This is our tradition. This goes back decades. This goes back centuries. This goes back millennia.
Yes.
And we have this gift for the period of time that we have it. And really, we only own it for a short time, and then we have to give it to the next
generation. Pass it on. Yeah. Once we become educators, and this is one of the things that, when we were at the academy together, we used to talk about a lot, was the notion that there's a difference between being a professional chef or pastry chef and being a chef educator, a chef instructor. And one of the major differences is that once you become an instructor, it's really all about passing it on, being a Sherpa for your students and getting them to the mountaintop. And it's not about you anymore. It's about their success.
Yeah, and those 50-pound bags of flour, that Sherpas your back right out.
So, I want to fast forward you a little bit, because we were there at the academy. You were teaching on the pastry side. I was on the bread in a different classroom with the breads, and then somehow, I moved on to moved to the East Coast, and you transitioned over into the bread side. And suddenly you were writing bread books. Then, I had done a couple of books. You were now writing books and furthering the curriculum on bread making at the Academy. And you stayed at the Academy for quite a number of years, you know, after I left, while you were doing your own books, doing product development for other companies. You had a lot of things going along the way.
Yeah, very, a lot of juggling. You know, you make it all sound very seamless. And of course, it wasn't like that.
Yeah,
it wasn't like that at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think the real thing was, you know, you inspired me with just watching you make bread and seeing the products that you could make in the kitchen and watching the students' faces light up. And when you left and the school came to me, and because at the time I was the education director, and they said, hey, you know what? First of all, fill in this gap where Peter was. And then why don't you make this out into a big program instead of just a short little segment? So if you remember Curtis Bagley.
I was just thinking of Curtis when you said that.
And he actually was in that lineage of yes. the California Culinary Academy.
He was kind of like in between you and me in that class, I think. He carried
yes.
for a while.
Yeah. And he's down in Florida now with wow. his own shop. So,
no kidding.
So,
good to know that. He was a great baker, yeah.
So, yes. And so he actually was my, I think, front of house guy while I was in the back flushing out the curriculum and putting more things into it. And wow. I'll tell you what, this is where mm-hmm. I have to thank the bread baking community, because I thought, all right, well, listen, let's have some artisan breads. You know, this was very hot. Let's get that in here. And so I went to Craig Ponsford, who at the time had a bakery called the Artisan Bake Shop. And I was like, okay,
Sonoma,
well, here's a no-brainer. I'm going to go here.
Yeah.
And I said, hey, Craig, you know, I have to write this program. Teach me how to do these things. And he was like, okay, come on in. Here's
how the great thing about Craig was that he was a graduate of the California Culinary Academy. So he was one of your alums.
So he was very much in, you know, into that. And as you know, he's a consummate instructor as well.
Yeah.
So I would learn things from him. I would go to Curtis and I would say, hey, Curtis, here, let's build this in. Let's do that. And Curtis would say, all right, I can do this, because he had the logistics of how bread works within a, you know, 5-hour class and things like that.
Yeah.
And then
the Bread Bakers Guild of America came into existence around that same time as well. So we were all able to tap into a deeper well of knowledge from the masters, the European masters that came over to this side.
Well, you know, and especially I have to also say Steve Sullivan from Acme Bread.
Right.
He opened his doors to me literally and said, here, come and work on the bench. Learn how we do this. Watch wow. how this. See how important scaling is, et cetera.
That was very generous of him.
I was able to bring those industry competencies into the program, which mm-hmm. really, and Curtis was able to interpret that. And so, you know, in that way, I was really kind of the facilitator between what the industry really needs in baking graduates and what the program at the school taught them.
That's amazing. That's fantastic. Before we run out of time in this segment, I'll just say a couple of other things that will lead us into part two when we come back. And
yes.
that is that while we were there, another thing that you and I both kind of got a chance to do while we were at the Academy, and you continued to do it, is to work on product development for companies that specialized in creating new products for the industry. So we used to get to work on these prototypes. We would create prototypes for major companies, which we're probably not allowed to even talk about, you know, on the air, but the big food producing companies. And sometimes we would all go to these presentations. We'd each work on 4 or 5 prototypes and present them ideas that wasn't our job to figure out how to mass produce them. It was our job to inspire the company with something they should be thinking about 5 years from now, right? And so let's just touch on that for a couple of seconds, and then we'll use that as a springboard to move into in part two to talk about what the new development that you're doing.
Great. That's great. So that that company that we worked for, it's still going strong. CCD Innovation, the Center for Culinary Development.
Exactly. Yes.
And they would take big name clients. And you're right. We have NDA, so we can't say who we work for. But I do explain it to people and say, you know what? Walk down the bakery aisle and walk down the snack bar aisle and walk down the cereal aisle in your grocery store. And those are the people that we would do projects for.
Right.
And, you know, it was like you said, you know, they take consumer reports, they take trend forecasting, and then they reach out to a number of chefs on their council. And you and I got to work on a couple of projects together because yeah. we both have the baking expertise. And we would come to a meeting and say, all right, you want low-gluten cookies that hit the sweet spot for afternoon snacking, et cetera. And then I would have four or five. Actually, they were called proto-seps at that point because it's a concept that yeah. we make into a shape.
Yeah.
And then the company in the room, you would have the marketing people, you'd have the financial people, you have the manufacturing people, and then you have like, you know, their chefs. And they would listen to about 20 or 25 presentations over the course of the day of different products. And then they go back and then they ruminate on all of that. And they come out with a product and they say, you know what? We like the shape that Peter's cracker had. We like that shape, but you know, Michael's flavor profile was really good. And how about, you know, Shelley put this particular, and so they would put things together and come up with something. And
it was amazing because it was one of the first chances I had to see at that scale, the scale of the food industry, you know, how much they would spend. They would spend, you know, hire the CCD to put together a panel of five chefs like us to make each of us five presentations, and how much it cost them to do that. And if they came out of that process with one or two usable ideas, exactly. they were happy. And yeah. I'm going, holy cow. And it was nice for us to get paid to be creative and to get and not that to figure it all out, but to just be creative and sort of like, you know, open the floodgates and just see what comes out.
And you know, part of that whole thing was for me learning to create and then let it go.
Yeah.
And say, I would make a cookie, and of course it was the best cookie in the whole entire world. And no, yeah. no cookie was better, not even yours, right?
Right.
And you know, they would say, oh, I like this little piece from it or something. So in the end, it was like, you know, you go to the Louvre and you see the Mona Lisa and you say, you know what? I was the one that told them to put her hand inside her cloak like that. That was what I said. And people are like, okay, good.
Right. I'll share my favorite moment from one of those situations. We have another colleague of ours from the Academy, Greg Tompkins, was also on that panel.
Yes.
And one day he and I got to do a joint presentation of some products that we had worked on. And I did mine and then he did his, and we would alternate back and forth. And so he did one of his, and it was a real interesting product. I can't even remember what it was. It was a baked good of some sort. And the team from the company, you know, as one of the guys said to Greg, he said, Greg, it's really interesting, but what, instead of baking it at 400, like you said, what if we baked it at 450 or 475, what would happen? And Greg looked at him and without blinking an eye, he said, well, you would probably volatilize the aromasticity. And they all started nodding like this. And a couple minutes later, he and I walked out of the room together and I kind of whispered to him and I said, volatilize the aromasticity? Where did you come up with that? He says, well, I just pulled it out of my butt. He said, I have no idea what it means, but they love hearing talk like that. And I said, now I understand how this works.
Guess what, though? And we can talk about sensory science. That's actually true. I don't know that the words are right, but the concept is true.
Which is going to lead us into, in part two, when we come back, I want to start by talking about the next, one of the other steps in your evolution as a chef, which is to become a master taster. So we want to hear about what that's about and how that becoming a master taster and all this other background has led to you now doing new product development for other companies. So let's come back after a short break. I'm with Michael Colanti, who's coming to us from San Francisco. I'm Peter Reinhardt. This is Pizza Quest. Come back for part two, and we'll continue this great conversation with Mike.
We'll be right back with more Pizza Quest right after this break.
This episode is brought to you by 818 Tequila. 818 creates their tequila using traditional methods at a family-owned and operated distillery in Jalisco, Mexico. 818 is created from fully matured blue agave from the Los Altos and Valles regions of tequila. It is then slow-cooked for over 30 hours, extracted using traditional Tahona wheels, distilled twice in copper pot stills, and aged in American and French oak barrels. This process creates the best-tasting, highest-quality tequila possible. Their tequilas have received over 20 blind tasting awards. They strive for excellence in every sip. 818's Blanco is sweet and smooth, with undertones of tropical and citrus fruits. Their Reposado is soft and balanced with notes of caramel and vanilla. Their Añejo is elegant and velvety, with crisp herbal notes and a warm vanilla finish. Visit drink818.com to learn more about their tequila and find it near you. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York, 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2 Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Well, welcome back to part two of Pizza Talk and Pizza. We call it Pizza Talk, but really it's Pizza Quest. We changed the name a couple of times for a year or two during the pandemic. We were calling the show Pizza Talk because we were focusing on pizzerias that were figuring out how to pivot during this unusual, amazing, crazy time that we've all been through. But we've had a chance to explore that. And so we've gone back to, I think, you know, the original vision of Pizza Quest, which is not only to explore the journey of pizza, but, you know, the journey of self-discovery through pizza. And today we're with Michael Colanti, who you see here as avatar is on the screen right now, the product developer, Michael Colanti, who's been talking to us about some of his the work leading up to what we're about to get into, which is some new product development. And so there's Mike. And Mike, before we took the break, I'm going to let you just talk over this image and then take us through some of the slides you have. After becoming a pastry chef, became a bread instructor, started writing books about bread. And then in more recent times, you became a certified master taster, which is something that most people don't know exists. And everybody's going to want to know, like, how can I become a master taster as well? We all think we're great tasters, but there's a science to all this. Can you tell us a little bit about what it took to become a master taster, and then how you use all of that and bring it all together, you know, through bringing science and taste and everything together to start to continue your product development work?
Sure. Oh, that's great. You know, you said, how do I become a master taster? You know, and my answer is, well, you know, you see that line over there? You got to get in that line.
Do a lot of tasting.
Yeah. So many people are like, hey, I just want to taste stuff and tell you about it. So, and this was a spinoff from my product development work with CCD that you and I were on. And I connected with a company, they're called Chef's Best. And they are an independent judging firm. And what we have is a panel of master tasters, and we evaluate consumer products, everything from cereal to soy milk alternatives to gluten-free cookies, anything that you're going to see in a grocery store shelf, we put it through a test, and we have master tasters who evaluate it. So I right now am a panel moderator for this group. But prior to that, for about 10 or 15 years, I was actually on the panel itself as a master taster. Uh-huh. And to become a master taster, jokingly, you have to eat a lot of things. Yeah. But I think that the real important thing here is to understand that I'm not a super taster. I can't, you know, walk into a room and say, oh, someone baked a potato here in tinfoil 4 days ago because that, or, you know, and there are super tasters and they can do that.
I think that's important to point out that you don't have to be a super taster to become a master taster. That's a pretty important piece of information.
No, you actually kind of don't want to be, because it makes you oversensitive, or can make you oversensitive to certain sensory attributes of a product. So if you took the bell curve of how people can taste, like with super tasters over here and people down here that can only taste five or six things, you actually kind of want to be somewhere in the center. You want to be where you're most like the community. Uh-huh. But the trick is you have to learn to calibrate your palate and describe what it is that you are experiencing.
Yeah.
From aroma, from visuals, from texture, etc. And I guess I kind of knew I had an interest in this from childhood, because I remember we used to go to the Jersey Shore in the summer, and there was a hotel there that had a big pool, and it was a salt pool.
Uh-huh.
And not a chlorine pool. And I remember one day coming out and telling my grandpa, I said, you know, I think they put too much salt in today. And it seems a little saltier, tastes saltier, and plus I float a little bit more. Wow. And he said, you know, okay, little Mike, you know, and so I was like seven.
And that's the point where the grandpa smacks you around a little bit and says, who do you think you are?
So he went over to the lifeguard, you know, because, you know, he was very supportive. And he took me over and he said, you know, my grandson said there is more stuff in here. And so they took out their little test and they said, you know what? There is actually two parts more per million of saline in this water than there was 2 days ago.
And thus a master taster was born.
And I was like, see, I told you. And everybody was like, you know, no one else could tell the difference.
Yeah, right. That's like the basketball player who looks at the basket and says that it's an eighth of an inch off, you know, and they measure it and they say, he's right. So
So first of all, you need to have that kind of like, you know, bent in order to, you know, be trained to be a master taster. But yeah. Before you go through the training, they do qualification tests, and they do these. There's a series of tests they do, and the most interesting one I always like was what's called a triangle test. And they will take, for example, they'll just take water. They'll just take tap water, and they'll put 4 parts per million of lemon juice in these two samples, and then 8 parts per million in this other sample. And they'll give you 3 samples, and your challenge is to say which one is different. You don't have to say why. Yeah, you just have to say this one particularly is different from these other two. And, you know, it's pretty challenging. Yeah. So they look at your scores, they test you again, and then they'll take the folks that have good basic discrimination abilities. And then they'll invest in training you and giving you, for example, let's train people on sweetness, right? Mm-hmm. So here at this one level, we'll have just, you know, plain water, and then we'll have peanut butter, and then we'll have canned soup, and then we'll have jam. And they teach you how to eat each one of these things and put it on a scale and say, you know, it's not better than that. It's not worse than that. It's just this much higher than that. And your ability to repeat that over different products is what makes you valuable as a human tasting machine.
So the two words that come to mind when you describe all that is one is to differentiate and discriminate, and then to articulate, or so we'll say discrimination and articulation of the differences, and giving you the language. So a lot of it is a language based skill, as being able to create the imagery or language equivalencies to compare it. This is like that. Am I?
That is a very clear way of explaining that story that I told.
It's a trainable skill if you've got the aptitude.
You need the aptitude, and they will train you, and then you will sit on a panel, and you know it takes you about 6 months to a year really to come up to speed. Because you're in there with people who have been doing this.
Yeah.
And at the beginning, you say, well, I think this is about an 8 on the scale of sweetness. And everybody else looks at you and goes, no, dude, this is clearly a 14. And you're like, okay.
So you have to go through your fair share of humiliation first to work your way.
You have to learn. And, you know, it's not a concept that makes sense now because everything is digital. And when you get off the plane, your phone automatically resets to whatever time zone you're on. But there was a time where you used to get off the airplane and then you would have to reset your clock.
Yeah.
To match that. And that's the analogy that clicks in my head because I'm old school that way. So.
But I love that because you just used an analogy, and analogies are almost like the heart and soul of this particular skill set. So how do you translate now? You've got the designation as a master taster. Do you actually get paid to use that skill?
Well, you sit on the panel for the chef's best sessions, and you get a fee for sitting down, for having that degree of just reliability and professionalism. And so, you know, you can get paid for sitting on those panels.
Isn't it nice to get paid to be creative and to be able to use a skill that, you know, that you've cultivated?
Well, I'll tell you what. And that's why I go back to something I said before that I tell my students, you know, if it's your passion, if you love it, just do it, get better at it. And, you know, you'll be amazed at how people will reward you for that. Mm-hmm. And the thing that the master tasters say to this very day, after the end of a 3-hour session, they say, wow, you know what? That was the easiest chef job I ever had because you're sitting down the whole time.
Yeah, right. And you're getting paid for your knowledge. Knowledge is power.
Exactly.
And I think that that's an important, as our students evolve in their careers, we want them to understand that at some point they want to be able to work with their head and not just their hands. And that's where the knowledge comes in.
Yes, absolutely.
So let's take that now and apply it to a very specific new situation for you. This we're looking at the slide where it says Roman Pizza Bread Project, Delfina Restaurant, San Francisco. Can you tell us a little bit about that and take us through this little slideshow?
Sure. Delfina Restaurant in San Francisco, they set up shop, I think, about 28 years ago.
Amazing.
And in their earlier years, actually, they won the James Beard Award, and they were very forward in their cuisine. After a couple of years, they put in a pizzeria.
Which we featured on Pizza Quest in our very first year. We have some great video footage of our visit at Pizzeria Delfina with Craig Stoll, the owner, and Anthony Strong, who was his pizzaiolo at the time. And so this is like, for me, a kind of a flashback to 10 years ago, 12 years ago, and now coming full circle to the next iteration of what he's doing.
Well, exactly. And in the interim, they've been able to set up a couple other shops in San Francisco and then down in the Silicon Valley. So pandemic forced all the restaurants to be closed. And slowly they were able to, like, you know, serve things through the window out onto the street, et cetera. And so Craig at Delfina said, you know what, this is a great time. We're going to remodel this original restaurant and we're going to knock the wall out. We're going to combine all the spaces together and we're going to reopen as a very authentic Roman cuisine spot. Wow. With pizzas and then other Roman items.
And for those people who don't know, the original Pizzeria Delfina was right next door to the original Delfina. There were two separate spaces next door to each other. And on the other side of Pizzeria Delfina is the original Tartine Bakery. All of this all on one block, along with a couple of the great stores like Byright.
Exactly.
And that one block, we did a whole series of episodes with them. We call that one block the Gastro. The gastro district, because there were so many great food places there. And so we visited both the Pizzeria Delfina and Delfina, but they were two separate restaurants. And now you're saying he's going to make them into one kind of cohesive space.
Knock the wall out, you know, brought in really, I mean, the architects and the designers, really, it's really a beautiful space. It's a, you know, they're looking at a hard opening like the end of the summer, like August, beginning of September. And they have a soft opening right now where they serve a lot of takeout. And then this new Roman bread that
which is what brings us to your collaboration with Craig Stoll and bringing those skills that we've been talking about for the last 40 minutes. Into the present moment. So what is this new bread?
So, you know, it's you know, as a baker, I'm like, hey, why am I on Pizza Quest? I mean, I love it. I'm so glad to be here. But I'm like, I got to present information and give information that pizzaiolo will also be able to use. And, you know, there's the trend with artisan baking, being in the same shows with the PizzaCon and all that stuff. But this gave me the opportunity to really explore the continuum and how on one end you have pizza and the other end you have bread. And it's really just a continuum of bread products, of dough products.
Right.
So here I go. So, okay, there's the official title. And so when we're back at the protocept phase, Delfina said, you know what, we want a table bread, but we don't want the Ligurian focaccia. We don't want something that's high, it's doughy, it's springy. I mean, it's a wonderful product in and of itself, but they said we want something a little bit different
something new and different. Yeah. So we're looking at, for those who are not, who are listening to the audio version, Michael and I are now looking, he's sharing some slides of what looks like classic Ligurian focaccia as sort of, this is what we don't want to do. We want to use this as a starting point, but not an ending point.
Okay. Yes. And you know what? I think this is what in sensory, we call this an anchor. On one end, we have this anchor, and on the other end, we have something else. So we're going to work in the middle there somewhere. Okay. And thank you for saying this is for audio, or it could be. The characteristic here is that the bread itself is about 1.5 to 2 inches high, and the crumb is fairly uniform, and the size of the holes is fairly small.
Uh-huh.
So it has a bread-like characteristic in a way, like a chewy kind of white breadish kind of thing. I'm doing great disservice to everyone who bakes Ligurian focaccia. But as far as describing it, that's where we are with this. So,
right. So
the other end of the continuum is the pizza bianca. And if you look at this thing, this is approximately an inch, a third of an inch to a half an inch thick. It's very, very long, and it has a striation in the cell structure that in a way looks like it could be puff pastry or something like that.
Yeah, large irregular holes.
Large irregular that are spread out horizontally.
Horizontally, yeah.
Instead of vertically the way the focaccia would be. And this, because of its thinness, loses moisture a lot faster. So it tends to be a little bit crispier and kind of crunchier when you eat it, as opposed to the chewiness of the Ligurian focaccia.
This photo looks to me like something that I had in Rome at the Campo di Fiore, the classic forno, what do they call it? The antico forno. Pizza bianca.
You know what, Peter? There's a real good reason for that, because that's actually where this is from. And
hey, did I make the panel?
Good for you.
Yeah. So that's
and,
so those of you who are listening, and have ever been to Rome, know what Michael's talking about. This is a classic. Long flatbread. And now he's showing us a photo now of one of these planks of dough. It's probably about 6-7 feet long that's about to go into the oven, right?
So this, yes, and this is properly called pizza alla palla, which literally means this is pizza that is loaded into the oven from a shovel. And this actually is a little moving video. Oh no, go back and show it. There you go. So you can see how really kind of thin this is, how extensible it is, etc.
It looks like a long pizza dough, basically, with a nice olive oil topping and bubbles.
And it is at this point, it is 6 feet long, and then it's going to be pleated onto a 2 foot long loading peel. That's the actual palla. And then that is unloaded into the oven. And what happens as it goes in, they scoot off about 2 or 3 inches of it. They let the heat of the hearth, grip that dough, and then they kind of coax the dough out so that its ending shape is about 8 feet long.
So that's they kind of jiggle it off of the off
they
of the
jiggle it and stretch it so it has a very much extensibility to it. And so here's a finished one here, and you can see this is
the full length now, like you say, 7 to 8 feet long.
Yes.
That looks almost like a giant sheet of matzah, like bubbly matzah in a way.
Well, it comes from that comes from that Middle Eastern flatbread
lavash
type of bread making, leavened and unleavened, where it becomes the plate that people eat from, or it becomes the scoop that people are eating their bowls of food with, etc.
And the cool thing about it is my recollection, because it's been a while since I've been there, but you go into the bakery and it's a long plank of dough. There's red and there's white. Some has some red sauce, some has oil and herbs. And you just hold your hands out to the size of the piece you want, and they just lop off a piece from the plank and weigh it. And they charge you by the gram. And it is so good that you always regret that you didn't hold your hands out wider, because by the time you get back to your hotel room, it's already gone.
Oh, maybe you even get that far. I don't know.
Yeah, but I know.
It's interesting, because what you were talking about here is like saying the width of the slab that you want them to cut across for you.
Yeah.
And in Italian, that is called attaglia or altaglio, depending on what region you're from. And that just means literally by the slice.
I see.
And what's the name of that restaurant? It's Triple Bean in L.A.
L.A., Nancy Silverstein's place, yeah.
Yes, they have hands on the wall. Like, you go like that, you go like that. There's a little arrow. This is what you do.
Well, she did tell us that she modeled that concept on the Campo di Fiore.
On Campo, yes. Yeah. Yes, because these guys, I mean, they've been making this since 1846, I think. this is the paradigm. This is one end. This is an anchor on a continuum, you know.
Gotcha. This is a steps along the way to coming to this new product that you've been developing.
Yes, yes. So those were the two things, the Ligurian focaccia and then this little, pizza bianca.
Yeah.
So, of course, now we go through the, we developed the protocept, and that took, I think we worked on that for about 2 months, different flour blends, different olive oil ratios, et cetera, et cetera. And, this is what we were able to come up with at Delfina.
Oh, wow. So now we're starting to see photos of the new bread, the actual something in between the two worlds that you, the anchors that you described.
Right,
And it's a thicker, beautifully bubbly loaf of bread with wonderful caramelization, pockets of olive oil. And we're seeing a close-up of it. We're seeing the outside only, but pretty soon I think we're going to see the cross-section.
I think you are. And here it is right here. So this is the height of the Ligurian focaccia. It's about 1¾ inches, 1½ inches, maybe 2 inches where the bubbles are. But you can see the cell structure is much more varied. We have small, we have extra large.
It's gorgeous.
You can see it's very very well distributed throughout.
It's kind of ciabatta like, wouldn't you say, Michael? It looks like the most beautiful ciabatta structure.
It has characteristics of a ciabatta. Yes, it does. But when I look at it in cross section, and I have to say, Instagram has really made me crumb sensitive these days, because everybody is showing the crumb shot on their focaccias and on their croissant and their sourdoughs. I see this as a little bit closer to maybe what a croissant could look like in terms of, because there's a lot of olive oil in here, and I can't give away the formula, of course.
Yeah.
But there is about 2.5 to 3 times more baker's percent of olive oil in this bread than there is in a ciabatta.
So, and it's part of what makes it work functionally for what you're trying to do. Before we run out of time, can you take us through the rest of the slides? Because I don't want to deprive our viewers. But now there's a really nice shot of three three levels of this bread? Is it all from the same loaf?
This is all from that very same loaf right there.
That incredible structure.
That very same loaf.
You look at it and you just want to sink your teeth into it.
That's exactly right. Yeah, it's got the crispy, kind of easy bite crust to it. And then the inside, really, it's like almost like chewing a sponge that's dipped in olive oil. Yeah. You know, it just releases as you eat. And
you don't have to be a master taster to be already tasting these images. Yeah. Here it looks like a couple of the bakers getting ready to do some more.
Here's what I have to tell you, because when you commercialize a product, you know, when I work with, one of the big food companies and they say, all right, that's great. Let's make enough that we can put this on every, supermarket shelf in America. Yeah. You know, you have machinery that you work with. You know, you have these huge mixers, you have all these things that you can regulate, you can dial in, and you can get the consistency that you want.
Yeah.
When you're working in a restaurant, especially, you don't have that consistency. I mean, the temperature changes. One day the temperature is 68, the next day it's 92, and bread behaves differently. The dough reacts differently.
Yeah.
There's a lot of tweaking you need to do. And then if you look at, before talking about human tasters being machinery, okay, I got two guys here who you can just see by their stature and by their hand width, et cetera, how very different they are. And so it's a question of how can we make things come out consistently here?
Right.
And these guys, I have to say, this team, I never worked with a team that was more diligent or more fun loving. You know, excellent. These guys were just like, okay, did we do it right? And they took such pride in this. So for these me, like that was unsung... more rewarding than any.
Yeah.
These are. I'm just going to go back to them real fast. This is Tio and Manuel. And really, they turned these things out. They turned these things out. So we came out and we said, okay, you know what? Here we go. We have a bread. And we're going to call it pane a la pala, which means bread off of a shovel. And it's a whole new category.
Uh-huh. And so I know that you were kicking around a lot of different names for this. So pane a la pala is the current, is the one that you've settled on for the name?
I'll tell you why. You know why? Because I'm one of those guys who will take five or six names. We were talking about calling it Lungo and Cuscino because it looks like a cushion and all that stuff. I put all the names down and I sent it to Massimo Bottura, who has right now the best restaurant in the world. And it's in Modena, it's in Italy, and he is very much classic oriented and interprets things. And I explained it to him, sent him pictures, and I said, what should I call this? And he said, oh no, you must call it pane pala because everyone knows the pizza bianca comes off the pala, and now you have pane, so you must call it that.
Pane pala, pane a la pala. I love it. We're coming down to the end. I don't want to lose the last couple slides, so let's keep going. There's four
loaves
side by side, and I, of course, the very artisan, very each one is its unique individual thing. Someday in the future, when they figure out how to mass produce this bread, you know, it will all look the same. But right now, enjoy it. And we're in the artisan discovery phase of a new product. Now this latest slide that you're putting up shows a close up of the structure, the crumb, the shiny gelatinized internal, cross section of the loaf, including the gluten threads that are just barely holding it together. The starches are totally shined and gelatinized. I'm just trying to create some words for the people that can't see this. You look at it and you go, that is an Instagram food porn shot.
Exactly. To me, that looks like, the best croissant webbing. It's got that whole thing to it.
And there's something so exciting about it when you see it that you just can't wait to try it. Okay.
Well, they serve it now as a table bread with Tigella and prosciutto and some fresh ricotta.
So this charcuterie that's in the slide is part of the spread that Craig put out for us when you brought me to the restaurant a couple of weeks ago and we did some tasting. And so we had this bread with all these various cool meats and anchovies and olive oil and cheeses. It was like a feast that I think if the restaurant were just serving that alone, it would already be a destination restaurant.
That was my food for the day. I ate that and I didn't have to eat anything until dinner time. Maybe I had a bowl of cereal.
Well, so. I didn't want to eat anything after eating all that because I didn't want to lose the lingering flavors that were still, I was enjoying it. So, okay, we're coming to the end. We've got only a minute left before the Zoom's going to cut us off. Are there any more slides? Oh, here's some.
Here's another one. They're just developing now some open face sandwiches to serve
That's going to bring in the lines for sure. Yeah, some beautiful meats, and then I think there was. That's all I have. Okay,
Before
we get cut off, I want to thank you, Michael, so much for sharing all this knowledge. We talked about a lot of stuff, but I think this idea of the evolution of an idea to a product and everything, the anchors and all the verbiage and language and articulation, this is all part of the journey. And here on Pizza Quest, we celebrate the quest as much as we celebrate the pizza. And I think that you've shared with us your long 40, I don't know how many years it is, at least 40 since I've known you, quest, to become, a person who can create some beautiful products. This could be a legacy product for you. I'm so glad you got a chance to work on it. Thank you for joining us today and sharing all this. We got to get you back. When Craig said he would come on when the restaurant reopens, maybe we get you and Craig on together and talk about the launch of these new sandwiches and this new bread, because it's pretty exciting.
Well, thank you, Peter, for those kind words and for giving me the opportunity to share with your viewers My tiny little piece of the pizza quest.
Well, congratulations on the whole journey and on the most recent chapter in the journey. I look forward to seeing you back in San Francisco. Brad English, our producer and co-founder, is watching this as we speak. And I'm sure we're already thinking about how can we get a camera crew back to San Francisco and film, this new chapter in the life of what you're doing and what Craig Stoll's doing at the pizzeria. So we're looking forward to it all. Thank you so much. Thank you all for joining us on Pizza Quest today. We'll see you on the next episode. May your pizzas all be perfect.
Pizza Quest with Peter Reinhardt is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.